Let's welcome John Morgan. You know, we were both friends of Charles Craft, the Seattle-based porcelain artist who died on the 12th of June. He was 72. He had had cancer for a couple of years. He had battled it, and he finally lost the battle. And it came as a great shock to all of us. And one thing that hit me when Charlie died is that, well, you know, here's another person of great interest. He led a very interesting life. He was very talented, extremely funny, very creative, and his life belongs to history now. And it just occurred to me, well, if his life belongs to history now, then the people who knew him have a responsibility to history. We need to remember him, and we need to write things down, commit things to memory, get them out there, because someday people are going to write books on Charlie. They're going to write doctoral dissertations on him, and so forth. And I know that you spent a good deal of time with him out in California at various events and had some correspondence and so forth with him. And I just said, well, let's begin with John. So do you want to talk a bit about Charlie Craft?
Yeah, I mean, I was really saddened by his death, of course. He was one of those people that, I mean, I knew he'd been very seriously ill for quite some time. But he was one of those people who I could never really imagine leaving us. You know, he seemed like somebody who'd be around forever, and now he's not. So that's an important lesson for all of us, is that we're not all here forever. And just because somebody is a good man like Charlie was, that, you know, you're not spared. Mortality gets us all. So we have to reap the benefits while we can of our relationships with such people. But he was really a refutation of this idea that, you know, in popular culture, the idea of people who are on the radical right is that, you know, they're all solitary loners and socially inept, and, you know, they don't amount to much in society. Charlie was the exact opposite of that. I mean, he was a very gregarious personality, and he had a lot of friends. And even though he was very dedicated to his political beliefs, he was also a very successful artist and traveled the world and did a lot of interesting things. And he was also unique in the sense that Tom Sunich has described himself in his youth as having been a right-wing hippie. And I've known a few of those now. I might even have qualified myself at one point in my youth. But I think Charlie was definitely one of those, although I don't think he came to his later political interests until later in life. But he was a bona fide hippie. I mean, he lived in this artist's commune in Washington State called Fishtown. I forget how many years he was there, but he was there for
almost
a long time.
Decade. Yeah, throughout most of the 1970s. It is interesting, though. One of the things that I learned about Charlie is, one of his friends, a good friend of his, a roommate of his for a while, somebody who know him for, you know, longer than me, maybe 15 or 20 years. This person said that one day they were waiting for a bus. Charlie never drove. He never had a driver's license. They were waiting for a bus in Seattle, and Charlie recognized a guy that he had seen at a speech by George Lincoln Rockwell in Seattle in the 1960s. And Charlie would have been about 16 at the time when Rockwell was there, or maybe 16 or 18, I forget the exact year. And the guy also recognized Charlie. And more than 20 years had gone by, or maybe 30 years had gone by. But they recognized each other. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. Charlie Craft, let's just say he was open-minded enough to want to go hear George Lincoln Rockwell speak when he was in high school. And, you know, in his travels around Europe and Asia in the 70s, he was seeking out all kinds of interesting characters. He went to Romania, and maybe there's just a date wrong on this photo, but there's a photo that I was given of Charlie in Romania with the brother of Codrianu. And it was supposedly in 1980. This is under communism. It could have been misdated. It could have been 1990, right?
That sounds more
Yeah,
I don't think Charlie could have gone there. I mean, it's not impossible, but I would be surprised. Yeah. Also, because I don't know that you'd be able to have meetings with Iron Guard people under Ceausescu in Romania. That seems unlikely, but who knows?
Well, yeah, but anyway, the fact is that this all this predates his sort of official story of when he in the late 80s, when he got interested in Liebach and met Adam Parfrey and people like that. I think that his interest in forbidden rightist ideas went all the way back to the 1960s when he was a teenager, which is an interesting thing. And it's something that the person who writes his biography, I'm sure there'll be a biography of Charles Kraft, maybe more than a few, because he made a real contribution in the arts and he was a fascinating person. He deserves a first-class biography. The person who writes a biography of Charlie is going to have to clarify these things. I know that in the 1970s, before Julius Evola died, in the early first half of the 1970s, Charles was in Rome and somebody tried to introduce him to Evola.
So, yes. Yeah, he loved to tell that story.
Yeah, so I don't remember the story. I don't think he actually told it directly to me. Maybe I heard it from you first. But what was that story? Oh, he also met Picasso in the early 70s. I know that's not a rightist thing, but So go ahead. What was the Evola story? Yeah, don't let me interrupt.
What he told me was, I believe, if I remember correctly, it was 1970. Or if it wasn't exactly 1970, it was right around then. He was on his way to India for the first time. That was something that Charlie and I had in common, actually, you know, because I also spent a lot of time in India, and you know, he was a fellow sort of nonconformist conservative, we could say, like myself, who was fascinated by the East. So that was something we always bonded over. But he was on his way to India the first time. And, you know, it wasn't like today, well, you know, pre-corona today, when you could just fly directly, you know, you had to make several stops along the way. And he was in Rome and he was spending, I think, like a week or so there because he had a flight booked to travel on the rest of the way to India. And he went into a bookshop, and I guess he wound up in, you know, sort of like the New Age section or whatever they would have called it then, and was browsing the books. And there was a young fellow there who started talking to him, and he just said, "Oh, are you interested in these sorts of ideas and these sorts of books?" And Charlie said, "Well, yes, I am." So the fellow said to him, "Well, then you should really meet our mentor, Julius Evola." And Charlie at that time didn't know who Evola was. So, you know, to him, that was just like, okay, sure. You know, why not? So he told me, you know, after having a brief conversation with this guy, they went out to the street and they went to a payphone, and this guy called Evola, and told him that, you know, he had this American guy who he wanted to introduce to him. And, Charlie said that the guy put him on the phone with Evola, and that Evola spoke to him in English. And he explained that, you know, he would love to meet him, but that he wasn't able to do it that week as his mistress was on her deathbed and he didn't want to leave her side. So he asked if Charlie would meet with him the following week, but that was after Charlie had his flight to India. And he said, if he could have gone back in time, knowing what he knew later, of course, he would have decided to stay to go meet Evola. But since he didn't know who he was, you know, he just said, sorry, you know, I've got this flight. And he went on to India anyway. Unfortunately, that's the extent of the story. But I think it's probably true because we know that Evola had a lot of young students in Italy, you know, who he had at his apartment in Rome. Who he sort of trained in the ideas of traditionalism and you know, traditionalist conceptions of politics and so forth. So, you know, I'm sure that you know, it happened just as Charlie said. It's just unfortunate it didn't go beyond that.
Yeah, that is very interesting. That's the story that I heard from you, definitely. And thank you for the the refresher. Yeah, it's fascinating, though. I didn't really know that Evola spoke English. That was the thing that was most surprising to me. It's totally made sense, though, given the context, because, yeah, he did have a large number of young followers at the time. Somebody would definitely just strike up conversations in bookstores. I remember my whole life made a fateful direction, striking up a couple of conversations. There were two instances where my life took a fateful turn, striking up conversations with right-wingers in bookstores. So yeah, it's a totally believable kind of event. And I do know that at the time, Charlie was very interested in Hinduism, but he was also very interested in Aleister Crowley. So he was interested in a lot of heterodox spiritual ideas. He was going off to study with various gurus in India. So the idea of you know, somebody saying, hey, do you want to meet our mentor? That wouldn't have seemed weird to him at all. It would have seemed really intriguing.
Well, I think he, even more than Hinduism, he was interested in Buddhism. But,
yeah.
As I remember, though, I mean, he did consider himself to still be Christian late in life. He just sort of saw these other things as like informing his own belief, but that he still considered himself to be a Christian.
That's interesting in and of itself. I didn't know that. What exactly did he say? What was the context?
I actually don't remember. I think he did mention it to me at one point, but this is something I've heard from other people that he said. You know, I don't know if you want to go chronologically or jump around, but
let's go chronologically. Yeah.
Well, the first time I met Charlie was at the first of your retreats that I went to, which I think was in 2011. I think you'd had one before that. I'm not sure. And Charlie and I shared a hotel room, and we had never met before that, but I was still living in India at that time. I was just back in the U.S. visiting. And so, of course, we hit it off talking about that. And I remember he was reading the Fenris Wolf Journal, which is this Swedish esoteric journal that's published in English, that, you know, all the bigwigs of esotericism today publish in. And it was very exciting because it had been a big deal in the 90s, and then it had gone out of print for a while, and this was the first new issue in, you know, something like 15 years. So I remember we talked about that, and just about India and about his work. But he was always completely unpretentious. I didn't realize until later what a big name he was in the art world. You know, I mean, he was always very matter of fact about himself, and never made a big deal out of his position or his connections or anything like that. I can't remember if it was that. I think I met Charlie at every retreat of yours that I went to, and I went to three. One in 2011, one in 12, and one in 13. And I think Charlie was at all of those.
He went to a lot of our retreats. Yeah, I think he went to, well, at least three, maybe four or five. We started doing retreats in Santa Cruz in California in 2011. And we did them sometimes twice a year. So we did one early in 2011, and then we did another one late in 2011.
That's the one I went to, the second
one. We did another one early in 2012. That's the one that Jonathan Bowden attended. I believe Charlie was at the retreat that Bowden was at. I'm pretty sure he was. And then we did another one in the fall of 2012. You know, one or two in 2013. Then in 2014, I left the Bay Area and I moved to New York City. So we did one, I believe, in 2014 only, and that was in the fall. And then one in the fall of 2015, and that was the end of it. So I think we did a total of eight retreats, and I'm pretty sure Charles came to at least five of those. He was a pretty regular, faithful attendee. He really seemed to enjoy these things.
Well, I don't remember which year it was, but I know that at one of the ones that I attended, he himself gave a presentation about his work, which was fascinating. I think he showed that video, which is still on YouTube, where, you know, he sort of introduces his type of ceramics, you know, this spone, the cremains, you know, that he uses human ashes as part of his ceramic work, you know, at the behest of the of the person whose ashes it is. Of course, he doesn't. Didn't go around acquiring random people's ashes. He did this.
It wasn't like Fight Club, you know, stealing body fat from liposuction clinics and things like that. Charles, just for some background, because I know there's some people who don't know about him. Charlie Kraft was born in 1947, and he died this year. He was a Seattle area artist, and he was an artist from an early age. He was a poet and an essayist and a visual artist. He became a painter, and initially when he became a painter, he was in the fine art school of the so-called Northwest Mystics. Morris Graves was probably the best known person in the school, but there were other figures. And Graves was a huge inspiration to Charles, but he wasn't a real direct mentor or anything like that, although they did meet a number of times. But Charles's early work is painting. It's fine art. And then he started getting into what became known as lowbrow art. And that was somewhat prompted by this fellow named, who was known as Von Dutch. Von Dutch was a pinstripe artist, a hot rod and, motorcycle pinstripe artist who did work for a lot of famous people in Hollywood and so forth. And in the 80s, Charles got to know him and they exchanged letters and stuff like that. Von Dutch, by the way, was a self-described neo-Nazi. And that didn't bother Charlie at all, apparently. And Charles created his first art that involved themes from the Third Reich, basically inspired by Von Dutch. He created these friendship windmills, these Dutch Delft windmills, but they weren't the conventional windmills that you see in the Netherlands. They were windmills of friendship. And you can see them online, just Google Charles Kraft and Von Dutch or Charles Kraft windmill. And anyway, so they got to be friends. And in the 80s, Charles was involved in the Seattle art scene. He became very much a part of it. He was an organizer of exhibitions. One of the big exhibitions that he helped create was the Custom Car Culture exhibition that traveled all around America. And that was one of the defining exhibitions for the lowbrow art movement. And lowbrow art basically grew out of things like pinstriping, tattoo art, and other sorts of, well, things that aren't fine arts, right? I imagine painting on black velvet and stuff like that would be part of it as well. And Charles got into doing ceramics in the blue and white Delft style, but with a kind of twisted lowbrow sensibility to it. So he started doing things called disaster ware. So instead of, painting like tulips and windmills in Delft style or something like that, he was painting, the sinking of the Andrea Doria or the explosion of the Hindenburg or the bombing of Dresden. Again, this is interesting. He wanted to commemorate the bombing of Dresden, and this was in the early 80s. So he became quite famous for his ceramics. He was less famous for his paintings in the Northwest Mystic School. That was a local thing, and his art was collected locally and displayed locally, and he was a known figure in the Northwest art scene. He was a central figure. But when he started doing his Delft porcelain stuff with its wild and mordant sense of humor, that became internationally known. He had international exhibitions He was profiled in all the major publications and things like that. He was getting residencies to go teach ceramics at various places. And he was quite celebrated. And yet at the same time, he was quite openly incorporating imagery that harked to the far right. So anyway,
this is where maybe we should bring up his connection with Laibach, because he said that was when he first got interested in the idea of combining political imagery, incorporating it into his work. And for those who don't know, Laibach is a Slovenian band that goes back to 1980, but they were always more than just a band. They had a parallel art movement that apparently is separate from them now, called Neue Slovenische Kunst. But what both of these had in common was that they would take elements of fascist and national socialist and communist art and alter it, or put their own slogans into it. And you're never quite sure when they're being serious and when it's just a joke, when it's satire. They obviously love that ambiguity. I don't think you'll ever find much resembling a concrete political statement from Laibach, but their way of doing this was just brilliant. Although I'll just add, I do think there's an inherent critique of liberalism in Laibach, although I don't think it's essentially from the left or the right. It could be either. But in any event, Charlie knew them. He was fascinated by their work. And he got in touch with them around, I guess, 1994 or so. And they were getting ready to do a tour across Europe, and which included Yugoslavia, which, of course, former Yugoslavia, which, of course, at that time was still undergoing the Yugoslavian wars of the early 1990s. But Laibach never allowed this to intimidate them, being from former Yugoslavia themselves. So I don't remember exactly how it transpired, but he got in touch with them, and they ended up hiring him to be their official photographer. And I guess he was sort of a spokesman for them as well. And he went with them everywhere on this tour, but the most important destination, which is still one of the things Laibach is most famous for, is that they performed in Sarajevo in late 1995. The war was just ending, but it was actually still under siege by the Serbs. I don't think there was any shooting going on while he was there, but it was still under siege by the Serbs, because it was just before the UN forces came in. And they gave a concert at the, I don't remember what the venue was, some theater in Sarajevo that survived the siege. And there's an actual video that I didn't find this until after he passed away, but I was looking around on YouTube. There's a lot of videos of Charlie on YouTube, by the way, including one of him from Fishtown from the 70s, where he's speaking about his life there. But anyway, there is a video of him in Sarajevo talking to an Associated Press reporter. It's not long. It's just a minute or two. But he explains, that they've come to Sarajevo to try to see what good they can do. I mean, although Laibach is a very obscure band in America, they were very well known in Yugoslavia, and of course for the people of Sarajevo, this was amazing. I mean, they'd just gone through several years of war, so to have this concert there was really something quite significant for them. So Charlie always spoke about that experience as one of the high points of his life. And he told me that was when he first came up with the idea of incorporating political imagery into his work. And you can kind of see that he borrows some of this Laibachian NSK sort of, you don't know how serious he's being. he uses this far right imagery, and it's like, if you look at it from one perspective, maybe it's a joke. If you look at it from another, maybe he's making some kind of a political statement, but he leaves it obscure. And in that sense, I think you could almost see his work as like a branch of of Neue Slowenische Kunst or Laibach Kunst. You know, he clearly you know, imbibed something of their spirit. And I know he kept in touch with them for many years thereafter. I know he told me they were unhappy when all the, we should probably talk about this as well, but in 2013, Charlie got in quite a bit of trouble because it was exposed that, you know, he was an evil right winger. And then, you know, all the people in the art world who had been praising him started to say, well, maybe, you know, we thought this stuff was just ironic. Maybe he's being serious about it. And there was an article in the New Yorker and a number of other big magazines. And he went through a lot of trouble because of that. Maybe we can talk about that in more detail later. But he told me at the time that the Laibach guys weren't very happy that happened. But then I saw him again a few years later and asked him about it. And he said, well, we've reconciled now. Everything's okay. So
yeah, I remember in 2016, I was in Seattle and Laibach came to town on their tour, their Spectre tour. And Charlie went there with me and a few friends to the concert. And well, he couldn't get us in, but yeah, the people knew who he was. I mean, I think he got to hang out with the band briefly and stuff like that. So that was fairly cool. At first, there was some kind of guff that happened where they didn't recognize him or something. It was just people who work the door, right? But I believe that he ended up hanging out with them again. And so yeah, I think he was valued by them for years. He brought them to Seattle.
Yes, you mentioned this before. Yeah,
you know, had some kind of event where they played. So
I think that was even before Sarajevo, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was before that. He first heard about their work. He found one of their CDs in the late 80s, and
that's how you did it back then.
Yeah.
No internet.
Yeah. And it's the one with Life is Life on it. I can't remember.
Opus Dei. Yeah. Opus that was the Dei, first one I found too. That's still my favorite.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, he found Opus Dei and he really got into it and started exploring it. And that was the beginning of this collaboration.
Yeah. I know that he associated with them for many years there was something else I remembered about his relationship with them, but I've just forgotten it again. It'll come back to me.
Well, but, sure. So let's go back to some of the time you spent with him. One of our writers, our mutual friend, Jeff Costello, wrote a piece called Bicoastal Adventures in Modern Art, talking about bumming around San Francisco with you and Charlie Kraft.
I forgot that he'd written about retreats. That. I would come out to California for your retreats. And then I would, you were always very kind enough to put me up and I would always spend a few days at your place. And often Charlie was there too. So, you know, we got to hang out outside of just the conference. So that was always cool. And yeah, I remember we went to this, is it the San Francisco Institute of Art?
I think so, yeah.
I don't think you were with us that day.
No, I wasn't with you. I don't know what I was up to that day.
You might have been getting ready for the retreat, because I think it was before. But Charlie and Jeff and I went there, and it was, I think Charlie enjoyed it, but it was obvious that, you know, he thought that the stuff was just crap. I mean, it was this, you know, really typical, you know, for these days, you know, POMO, you know, kind of stuff. I mean, you know, not much in the way of, like, you know, what I would call great art or that interesting art, but, you know, we enjoyed it. And there was one exhibit, I have a photo on my Facebook page where they had these plastic plants on the floor and you had to kind of like get down, like lay down on the floor in order to look at them. So I have a photo of myself and Charlie doing this. Becoming part of the exhibit, I guess was the point of it. And there was another on the wall, there was one work that was just like a small black square that was kind of like a squiggly line. it was on the wall, and Charlie saw this, and I remember he said, "Oh, look, they have Hitler's mustache," he said. So there's another photo of the two of us with our fingers under our noses, and we're pointing at the mustache on the wall.
Yeah, those are both at Countercurrents, actually, I think, in the Jeff Costello article. Yeah.
So, yeah, Charlie was always fun to hang out with. Yeah, I remember we just bummed around San Francisco and ate Chinese food and had a couple beers. And, it was always fun out there. I don't remember. I remember many things he told me, but I don't remember where or when for many of them, you know, because he was always just full of stories. Mm-hmm. He also came to India. You know, I was living in Goa in 2013. And Charlie was very fond of Goa. I know he'd been there many times. And he came right around the time I moved there from Bangalore. And he was going to the Kumbh Mela, which is this massive, massive religious festival that's held in northern India only every 10 years. So it's a big deal when it happens. And Charlie wanted to go, and he really tried to persuade me to go. But, you know, I just moved there, and I was working at the time, so I just didn't have the time to go there. Plus, you know, traveling around India isn't always the easiest. Anyway, so I apologized to him, but I said, sorry, I'm going to have to sit this one out. But I know he had a great experience there, and he had some photos of himself on Facebook, you know, hanging out with some young people there, like young Western hippies. He was doing some sort of Buddhist chanting with them, which I can't imagine what they would have thought about him if they had known what his actual interests were, but he didn't care. He clearly enjoyed it. And that was right around the time that, this New Yorker article appeared and all this explosion happened with his reputation, which he didn't really seem to be that bothered by. He didn't like it, but he didn't freak out or anything. He just sort of seemed to think, well, you know, now I'll have a new audience for my stuff, which I guess was true. I know he had many people from our circles who commissioned work from him after that. And I guess that sort of kept him going for the final years of his life.
Yeah, Charlie was famous for how cheaply he lived. He lived in a really cheap ramshackle house. Throughout the 70s, he basically squatted in an abandoned fishing shack in Fishtown. And he loved to eat at cheap restaurants and travel very, very cheaply. And so, yet he actually had a pretty good income from his art. So he saved a lot of money, I think. I think he squirreled a lot of money away. And so his father was, you know, in his 90s when he died. And Charlie was mindful of that. He thought, well, I could live a very long time, and he wanted to have some money for retirement. So he, I think, had a cushion when he started getting galleries canceling and stuff like that. So yeah, he weathered that storm better than a lot of people, I imagine, would have. He got canceled, you know, in 2013. And yeah, he was at the Maha Kumbh Mela when he heard from this art critic, this woman, Jen Graves, that she was going to write some expose of him. The hilarious thing, though, is that this was an open secret. He made no attempt to hide the fact. For instance, he won a competition, an essay competition, debunking outrageous Holocaust fables back around 2005, I think it was. And this was known. It wasn't a secret. He in one of his interviews, I think it was with, Salon or something like that, he spoke about how he was genuinely interested in these far-right movements in the interwar period. He was open about this kind of stuff. It's just that people didn't have ears to hear. I think a lot of people took it as ironic, or they thought, well, he's just so interesting, or he's a strange sort of hippie dude, whatever, right? But they didn't feel threatened by it until really 2013, when this story came out, putting it all together and calling him a neo-Nazi and a Holocaust denier and all that kind of stuff. That really irritated him. He never got into anything because he was full of hate or had narrow-minded or whatever.
He I never heard Charlie express hatred for anybody.
Yeah, yeah. He was one of the most widely traveled people I know, one of the most widely read people I know. I'm a big reader, and Charlie was always dropping names and recommending books. It's like, I never heard of that author. I was always jotting things down in the notebook when I would hang out with him. And anyway, he got into trouble because he was an open-minded person.
Yeah.
And it hurt him and baffled him that other people would pretend to be open-minded but weren't, right? He was being taken advantage of, I think, by a lot of people, a lot of like scammers and phonies and fakes, because he didn't understand that other people didn't operate with his same kind of open-minded operating system, put it that way. So anyway, he was hurt by it. He was baffled by it. I think he was very upset when people in his own family didn't want to have Thanksgiving with him and stuff like that. But he didn't feel like he had done anything wrong. In fact, he felt like he had done everything right. He felt they were wrong. He didn't have any self-doubt. He had no shred of moral self-doubt. And that, I think, was a very, very strong thing that helped him go through this. They were wrong. He was right. There was no question in his mind. And he was disappointed. I'm not mad. I'm just very, very disappointed. That's sort of his attitude about all these assholes in the art world and so forth who wanted to disavow him and so forth. So,
well, I think his interest was primarily in the old right, because I remember at one of the conferences, I was still with Arctos at that time, and I asked him if he was interested in any of our books, and he thought the Avila was interesting, although I think he'd already bought all of those, and he wasn't impolite about it, but I could get from what he told me that he just didn't find the new rights and the sorts of stuff that we were concerned with at that time to be interesting. His interest was more in, like you said, the interwar period, World War II. He did extensive research on the Iron Guard in Romania. You mentioned that photo before, but I know he made several trips there. He sent me a couple of articles that he had published about the Iron Guard. There's one story he was particularly interested in researching that it's often been claimed that during the brief period in, when was it, 1940 or 41? The Iron Guard was briefly in power in Romania, not for long, but there's a famous story that in Bucharest, the Iron Guard took some Jews and threw them while they were still alive into a butcher machine. And he went and researched this story, actually talked to some people who had been living in Bucharest at the time. And his ultimate conclusion was that, it was made up, that it was a bullshit story. But not just that. I mean, he researched the Iron Guard extensively. Well, maybe this I should then say, I guess the last time I saw him in the US was at your 2013 retreat, which was later in the year after he was in India for the Kumbh Mela. And then I didn't we corresponded off and on, but I didn't see him again till almost 5 years later. But he had come He had flown to Switzerland. This would have been March, I think, of 2018, because he had actually, they wanted to do an exhibit of his work at some museum. I don't remember which, but the usual story, after these articles came out, he got there and then they got cold feet and decided, they didn't want to go ahead with it because, they didn't want to host the work of a Nazi. So it was canceled. And so he was in Europe and he had nothing to do. So he knew that I was in Budapest, so he decided to take a trip here. And he stayed with me at my flat for a couple of days. He happened to arrive on March 15th, which is a national holiday in Hungary, because it's the commemoration for the date Hungary declared war on the Habsburgs in the 1848 revolution. So that night, you know, I happened to meet with a bunch of my friends at a pub, and Charlie came along and imbibed several beers, which didn't strike me as unusual at first. But then he admitted to us later in the evening that I think that was the first time he'd had alcohol in decades. But he, for whatever reason, he decided to join us that night, and he had a few, but he seemed quite happy with his first taste and all that time. But my Hungarian friends really liked him, and we were sitting at different ends of the table, so I actually didn't hear everything he told them, but I was talking with one of my friends who had been there just recently, and he reminded me that Charlie had told them that he had spent some time in Hungary when he was first learning ceramics. I think this would have been in the 90s. You know, I am planning to write a tribute and a remembrance of Charlie for Countercurrents, and I'll try to get more of the details exactly right, because I think my friend actually remembered the name of the town where he stayed. It wasn't Budapest. But anyway, he apparently spent some time in Hungary studying ceramics with a master here. And he was clearly very fascinated by Central and Eastern Europe and the Balkans. And his interests, of course, were broader than that. But he seemed to know a lot about the history of this region, which is unusual for an American. But that trip was, it was a lot of fun. But we could kind of tell that there was something not quite right with him. I hadn't seen Charlie for a few years, but he just kind of seemed discombobulated. You know, it's slightly confused. He was trying to make arrangements to fly back to the U.S., and I had to really help him because he wasn't really capable of figuring it out on his own. And I, you know, at first I thought, well, maybe he's just jet lagged or, you know, tired or something. But after a while, it seemed like, you know, this was something deeper. And sure enough, it was. He left to fly back to the U.S. and it was only a few days later that he went to the doctor, and that was when they found out that he had this brain tumor. And unfortunately, I never had the opportunity to meet with Charlie again after that. We corresponded a bit, and he was nice enough to send me a copy of his, I believe it was his only published book of poetry from the 1970s. And he was kind enough to send me a copy of that. But that was the last time I saw him. And we thought after that, you know, he had an operation and they thought that might be the end of it. And he did recover for a while, but as is often happens with these things, it did come back. I just wish I'd been able to see him one last time before he left us, but unfortunately it just wasn't possible. Parts of the world.
Yeah. Well, Jeff Costello and I had dinner with him in Seattle the night he was to fly out to Switzerland. And we noticed that he seemed really tense and discombobulated, and we did not really know what was going on. But the one thing that really struck us as odd is that he ordered a mixed drink at dinner. And he said, you know, I haven't had a mixed drink in 30 years or 20 years or something like that. It was a long time. Right. Charlie had a drinking problem, and I think that he stopped drinking by the early 1980s. So, yeah, we're talking more than three decades. And we just thought, okay, pre-flight nerves and the fact that he was upset about this cancellation. But, yeah, he didn't seem like himself. He seemed a little off. You noticed it. Mike Polignano noticed it. And a couple days after he got back, one of his friends noticed it and rushed him to the hospital. And they found the tumor in his head. And that very day, he went under the knife. And as soon as that tumor came out, he was his old self again. He was totally normal, more, you know, relaxed and funny, not uptight and discombobulated. And we thought, wow, this is a new lease on life. But it was the same kind of cancer that John McCain had. And, that kind of stuff comes back. So it came back about a year later, and they took it out again. And after that operation, he had balance problems and things like that. He was psychologically normal, but he had some physical issues. And then, another year later, it had recurred and he died. So he battled this cancer for a little more than 2 years, and it finally got him, which is really sad. So he's only 72. His father lived into his 90s. You think what this guy could have done in terms of art if he had had an extra 20 years, because, you know, he was highly motivated and he was one of the most hardworking people I know. He was always willing to like take time to do things spontaneously with friends. You know, I would pop over and hang out with him and we would talk, and he would be painting ceramics while we would talk, you know. So he was always working, but he was always really easygoing about, you know, sharing time with friends. One time I was with him and he showed me something fresh from the kiln. It was the first Ayn Rand piggy bank. And it was the first of firing. It was not yet glazed, but it had been fired. And so it was just a white porcelain Ayn Rand piggy bank. And I looked at it and I said, you know, this really needs a cigarette. And he says, oh yeah, I've got some cigarettes here. He had like a whole tray full of porcelain cigarettes. Because he would use cigarettes in some of his sculptures. And so he attached a cigarette to the Ayn Rand piggy bank, and then he glazed it and fired it. So I had a little tiny creative role in the Ayn Rand piggy bank by suggesting the cigarette. But so anyway, I have I think the first Ayn Rand piggy bank, the first or the second one that he made. Another Countercurrents donor bought. He donated a piggy bank for our fundraiser, I think, in 2018. And so another Countercurrents donor has one of those as well. But yeah, it's an absolutely hilarious, charming piece.
A lot of his work was. I mean, some of them you would just, well, like the forgiveness one, or
yeah,
the Hitler teapot. I mean, these things just... Yeah, yeah. His sense of humor was definitely incorporated into his work. Yeah. I mean, he was serious sometimes too, but yeah, he knew how to be funny.
Oh yeah, he had a great sense of humor. He was definitely one of the most funny people I've ever known. So are there any other stories or recollections that come to mind about his travels, about his ideas, stuff like that?
I'm trying to remember them all and write them all down so that, you know, I can write up my own contribution to mm-hmm. what you were discussing earlier. But I can't think of any other major ones right now. I know if I keep thinking, I'll remember more.
One story, I hope we have a recording of this and we can make a transcription, is he was in Slovenia in the 90s, and he was friends with this guy who I think was Croatian or Slovenian. And they decided that they would drive, the guy was going to drive Charlie from Slovenia all the way to Sicily, and they would visit Aleister Crowley's Abbey of Cephalu. Is that what it was called? The place that he put together where he was living in Sicily before Mussolini ran him out. And so anyway, they took this trip and they went there and they found that, you know, the building is like a boarded up ruin in the middle of like a concrete block housing project or something like that. And so anyway, they went there and they broke into it and spent the night there. And Charles found a lock there and took it as a souvenir. And later he created a porcelain shrine for this lock from Aleister Crowley's place in Sicily, which is a very cool story. So I hope we get a complete account of that from his own mouth in one of these recordings that we have. So one of the things I'm having people do is do recordings of some talks and interviews that we recorded with Charlie. Also, he was on three shows of Carolyn Yeager's The White Network. Now, Carolyn was not a person that I thought would be particularly receptive to the idea, but she turned out to be very, very nice about it, much to my pleasure. I wrote to her after Charlie died and told her, and she hadn't heard, I believe. And she said, well, you know, if you want to transcribe these appearances on my podcast, you're welcome to. So we have three recordings of Charles up at Countercurrents that we're getting recordings, transcriptions made of. We'll get the ones that Carolyn made. And then I have some recordings somewhere in my archives of a couple talks he gave at Countercurrents retreats. And so I'll find that audio and put that up eventually. So it's like I said, it's important now that he belongs to history. It's just important for people to record this stuff because he was one of the most interesting people I know, one of the most creative people I know, and he deserves to be remembered.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, he was really one of a kind. You know, there's only a few people in my life who I can genuinely point to and say, you know, I never knew anyone else like that person and probably never will again. He was one of those for sure.
Yeah, another one like that was Jonathan Bowden. And
I never knew him, unfortunately, but I can imagine.
Yeah, I met Jonathan three times and I spent the better part of a week with him the last time when he came to California to speak at a Countercurrents retreat in early 2012. And we had made plans for him to come back that fall, and we were going to take a trip to Robinson Jeffers' house, tour house near Carmel, because he was a big Robinson Jeffers fan. But, you know, less than a month after he flew home, he died suddenly, so he never got a chance to make that trip. But, yeah, there needs to be a good biography of Jonathan Bowden as well, and I might just have to write it myself.
I think you should.
Yeah, yeah.
And Savitri Devi.
Yeah, the Savitri Devi project is something I've been dabbling with for more than 15 years now. And I hit a couple of brick walls in it. And I need to crank that thing back up again eventually in the next few years. There are a couple of trips I need to make before I can say that I have dotted every I and crossed every possible T and tracked down every possible source of material. And then I'd be ready to write the book. But anyway, John, this has been fun and I look forward to your article. I think it'll be really, really enjoyable. I certainly want to see it and be very proud to publish it.
Oh, sure. So, yeah. Well, it's the only thing I can do to remember Charlie. I mean, I wish I could do more, but all I can do is offer my memories, unfortunately. And now, you know, I'm kicking myself because even, you know, talking about him, you know, and I think about, oh, you know, I wish I'd asked him to, you know, talk more about this or, you know, to explain something more. Because, you know, when you're with people, you don't think about the fact that they're not always going to be there, you know, to ask questions of, or, you know, could you explain that again or tell me that story again? Or so, you know, but I will certainly write down what I remember and what I did hear from him and hope that people will get some semblance of the sort of man he was.
Yeah, yeah. So let's do a quick look at some of the questions that have popped up here. There are a few. Danielle writes in with $3, such valuable information. Thank you. Thank you, Danielle. I always love hearing from you. Ulysses writes in, Nick is a great point man. He's talking about Nick Chilvey, who is helping us out with the chat. And he gives a $10 donation. Again, that'll be doubled. That'll be matched. So thank you very much. Gadius Maximus writes in your opinion, who are some of the artists on the right that particularly stand out today? White Art Collective comes to mind. John, do you want to answer that?
I'm sorry. Can you repeat that again? What exactly?
Yeah. In your opinion, who are some artists on the right that particularly stand out today?
Are we talking about visual art or
just any kind, I guess. Yeah.
Well, I mean, in terms of literature, I would definitely have to say Tito Perdue. I think he's certainly one of the greatest living American novelists. So, you know, he's definitely somebody who should be paid attention to.
I agree completely. Yes.
Who else would I name? I mean, that's one thing with the right. We have a lot of great thinkers, but not as many great artists. But, you know, of course, there are some. I'm just trying to think right now.
One person who does visual art on the right is A. Wyatt Mann, or Nick Bugis. And yes, he does cartoons and satirical sketches. But the stuff that he does is absolutely iconic. And I will never be able to suppress his hilarious caricature of Andrea Dworkin that appeared in one of the issues of Jim Goad's Answer Me. I saw that 20 years ago, and I still can't unsee it. It cannot be unseen. His stuff is hilarious. Of course, everyone's seen his Happy Merchant caricature, but he's actually an extremely talented visual artist, especially in the realm of caricature. So yeah, in terms of visual arts, he's definitely a person who comes to mind. There needs to be a great big deluxe coffee table book of his stuff someday. I would love to publish that just as a bit of culture jamming. You know, one person who pays attention to artists of the right is David Yorkshire, who runs this magazine called Mjolnir. And he has a website as well. And I definitely recommend you look at him. He would be the guy who's aware of all the living people who are doing work in the visual arts and literature who are on the right.
I know there's some in Russia. I just can't remember their names, but we've run articles about some of these people at Countercurrents.
Oh yeah,
this one guy. He's a buddy of Putin's, and he does amazing, you know, almost like Volkish art, you know, but with Russian themes. I just can't remember his name right now. But we've run something about him at Countercurrents. And the problem is now is that, you know, we really have to rely on people who are implicitly on the right in the art world, because artists know that if they come over, you know, they explicitly say that they're on our side, that they're going to be hounded for the rest of their lives. and you know, not everybody is so matter of fact about it as Charlie was. So, I mean, there's people I have suspicions about, but yeah, there's very few people I can think of who, you know, actually say, yes, you know, I am a right winger doing art today. You know, it's just a sign of the times that it's become almost impossible. You know that, you know, once you say that, you've basically relegated yourself to you know, to the margins. So I understand why people are hesitant to you know, come out and declare that. So
yeah, exactly.
I mean, if we want to talk about things that are implicitly right wing, there's tons of that. But
yeah, I mean, we could do a whole show on that. That I think would be that'd be a lot of fun, actually. So yeah, we should wrap up, John. Your work appears at Countercurrents, of course, and other places. How do people follow you? How do people see more of your work?
Well, the best would just be to follow me on social media. Either, you know, I'm on Facebook and Twitter. You know, I everything that I do, I generally post up there, so people can always find it. Because, you know, like you said, right now I've got stuff all over the place.
Yeah, but, yeah.
You'll always
see
my
problem to have.
Yes, indeed. But yeah, and of course you'll keep seeing my stuff at Countercurrents. So keep an eye out there. I know I haven't written anything recently. I've just been busy with other stuff, but there will be more.
Well, great. Next week I am trying to nail down an extremely special guest for this Sunday live stream. We haven't gotten it 100% nailed down yet, but I think once it is nailed down and once it is announced, a lot of you are going to be delighted. So I'm really hoping this comes through. I don't want to jinx it by saying anything more than that, but these live streams are a ton of fun. I resisted getting into this for a long, long time. I'm always a slow adopter, right? But I really find this to be highly enjoyable. I really enjoy the community of it all. I appreciate the donations that come through. It does really help us achieve our goals and stay afloat. So thank you, John, for coming on. Thank you, everyone who is listening and in the chat. Thank you for our moderators, our donors, and we will be back again for a week from today with another episode of Countercurrents Radio.